Good to go. Questions? So as I showed you before, what you're looking for the answers to your homework are dots. I've got lines because I kind of know how they're supposed to line up. You just, dots are good enough. So here you can see we've got all of the nearby so-called terrestrial planets, as we'll learn, kind of scrunched together. And as we go out, here's Pluto, the far end. And there's some sort of curve that goes through those. If we use the funny paper, then everything lines up on a line. Going. So, you know, you got an exam, chapters 1 through 4, on Friday. You guys schedule the help session for tonight here at 7:15. The home labs, I think, were supposedly due Friday, and actually it's been clear recently. So I think there's no reason that you can't turn in your scans by Tuesday 8 a.m. or something like that. And then I can mark them off when I hope also to return your exams on that same Tuesday. Best way to study for the exam is to look at the old exams. Yes, just those three pictures. And if you're not sure how to scan them, but if you hand that to a librarian, they can scan it and email it to me. It should work pretty easily. So we're talking about Home Lab 2. So Home Lab 2 is the polar motions. So those are three pictures of what the kind of major constellations look like at times separated by a couple of hours or so. So three pictures, typically you're going to scan those two pages and have one blank, but any other way will work. The Moon Lab, the first thing that you want to turn in to me, probably isn't due for about a month, but there's no reason not to start it now. It's a nice full moon there. That's showing pictures of the moon separated again by about 2 hours for three different pictures. And there you put all of those pictures together on one slot. So you can see how the moon moves during that time. Questions? Okay, so not only are the old exams online, the answers are online as screencasts, and even better is to bring in your own answers and talk to me about them in my office sometime. Pretty much, so the only class I'll have between now and the exam is a 9:40 class tomorrow, so there should be lots of opportunities to come in. Questions? Well, you notice we've got a change in the sort of stuff we have sitting around here. The spheres have all gone back to the back, and now we have stuff. And that kind of indicates a change in the point of view. So Aristotle never would have imagined that looking at an apple you can learn anything about how the moon works. But we see now that looks as if we can explain how the heavens work based on what works here on the surface of the Earth. And we've been talking about how people figured that out. So Copernicus was still squarely in the world of circles. I'm not sure he would have believed that you could figure out what was going on. And two times ago, we talked about Tycho. He decided that if we made careful observations, frequently as possible, as accurately as possible, over as long as possible time, that we could figure out how the heavens worked. I'm not sure he could have figured out using his own data. He wasn't that much of a mathematician, but he handed off the data on Mars to Kepler, and Kepler, over many, many years, trying every possibility, figured out three laws about how the solar system worked. And they were very much at odds with what Aristotle would have said. So first of all, instead of circles, we have something that looks a lot like a circle that's called an ellipse. So you can make an ellipse kind of a similar way that you make a circle, namely by looking at points that are equidistant, but not from one point, but from two points. So those two points that we keep the string taut from are called focuses, foci. And Kepler said that the sun is at one and there's nothing special at the other. So here's kind of the picture. In terms of vocabulary words, the thing that is kind of like the big diameter, that's called the major axis, and half of it is called the semi-major axis, and it's usually denoted by A, and that's what you plotted up in this diagram, right? So the x-axis was the semi-major axis of the 8 or 9 planets. The other axis, the minor axis, is usually denoted by B, at least the semi-minor axis is, and it's not quite so interesting. So major axis is what we use to denote the kind of overall size. We're interested in intensive variables that don't depend on size, and the thing that tells us shape is called the eccentricity. So technically speaking, eccentricity is the distance the focus is from the center divided by the semi-major axis. So if the eccentricity is zero, if the focus is at the center, then we're going to have a circle. If the focus is all the way to the edge, then we're going to have a line. And in-between things are going to be in-between. The planets' orbits look very much like circles. In fact, they very much look just like off-center circles, which is, of course, exactly what Ptolemy said, right, 2,000 years ago. Looks like an off-center circle. But if you have accurate enough data, you can detect that it's, in fact, an ellipse. So pretty much the same time as Kepler, working in Italy, Galileo kind of, I'm not sure what the right words are, claimed to have invented the telescope, but actually didn't. But he turned it to the sky. And in a very short period of time, he made a bunch of observations that contradicted what Aristotle would have said. So first of all, the sky didn't seem to be perfect. There were spots on the sun. The moon looked more like the Earth than anything else. It had mountains, it had valleys. He did calculate the height of those mountains, and they were comparable to the height of mountains on Earth. It looked a whole lot more like the stuff of the Earth than this imaginary quintessence. We can see the phases of the moon because they're close. Through a telescope, you can see the phases of Venus. And of course, when the moon is in the same direction as the sun, we're going to have crescent sorts of moons, but not so for Venus. If Venus is just emerging from the sun on the far side, as it did a few months ago, then we're going to have a full Venus when Venus moves in front of the sun, right? So these are the inferior conjunctions and the superior conjunctions. Then we're going to have a crescent Venus. So if Venus can show both full phases in conjunction and crescent phases in conjunction, then it has to be going around the sun. Aristotle would have said Venus is always more or less in front of the sun, so it should always show more or less crescent phases. Right? So Venus, at least, the data show pretty clearly, has to be going around the sun. People had argued against Copernicus because the Earth seemed to be in a special situation, right? Everything went around the sun except the moon. And Aristotle had argued that if the Earth were moving, things like birds wouldn't be able to catch up to the Earth if they briefly left the surface of the Earth. And so people have said, if the Earth is moving, the moon wouldn't be able to keep up. And Galileo certainly couldn't explain why the moon kept up, but he looked at Jupiter and saw that there were 4 moons going around it, and they didn't seem to have any problem keeping up with Jupiter. And the Milky Way, he resolved into zillions of dim stars, pretty close together. Okay, so Tycho data, Kepler analyzes the data, Galileo uses a telescope to make a series of observations that contradict what Aristotle would have said. Incidentally, Galileo was still a believer in circles. He hadn't come all the way around to Kepler's point of view. And finally, at the end of the class, we started to talk about Newton. So Newton is going to come up with 4 laws that are laws of both motion on the surface of the Earth and motion in the heavens, and they're going to explain pretty much everything. And these are laws that we teach today in our introductory physics classes. They are, in some sense, true. They're not fully accurate. That is to say, eventually we teach that Einstein has some corrections to what Newton had to say, but they're pretty accurate versions of how the world works. And they're surprisingly few to explain just about every imaginable phenomena. So if you want to send a probe to Mars, you don't need anything beyond Jupiter. You can very accurately predict exactly what's necessary to get to Mars. So his first law is that if there's no force acting on an object, it's going to go forever in a straight line at constant speed. If there is a force, then there has to be a change in velocity, right? Because it's basically what number one is also saying. And he calculates the change in velocity, and we usually denote changes with delta. The change in velocity is the force on the object divided by its mass times the time. The change in velocity per second, the change in velocity over time, is usually what we mean by acceleration. So often, Newton's law is rewritten that the acceleration is the force divided by the mass. Or you can put the mass on the other side of the equation and say the force is the mass times the acceleration. So his third law is the only one that we think survives exactly true today. And that says that any imaginable way that object A causes a force to be on object B, then it has to be the case that object B causes an equal and opposite force to be on A. So this is the law that's often abbreviated action-reaction, but that abbreviation won't get a lot of points on an exam. So you really need to remember the full story. And finally, Newton understood one force law. He understood that there were probably lots of other forces in the universe, but gravity seemed to be particularly simple. If you wanted to know the force that the Earth puts on the Moon or the Moon puts on the Earth, all you have to do is multiply together the masses, divide by the distance between their centers squared, and then multiply by this constant, which these days we can just look in a book that's called capital G, and that would give us the force of gravity on the Moon. We apply it to apples. We just take the mass of the Earth times the mass of the apple and divide it by the distance between their centers, which is pretty much the radius of the Earth, multiply by G, and we'll get the force on the apple. Questions?
What is G?
Numerically? It's in the back of the book. I have no particular reason to remember it. It's going to depend on what units you use. And yeah, I don't think I'll say any more. These sort of numerical constants are not worth remembering, and they're never going to appear on an exam. In fact, generally speaking, there won't be very many numbers on any of my exams, if you've taken a look at old exams. But yeah, the numerical value is in the back of the book.
And the R stands for levels of
degree? So that's the distance between their centers.
Because I remember I just started looking at the first exam. Yeah, the one where the sun is twice the radius, but still the same mass.
Right. So I guess I'd have to look at exactly the question. Yeah. If I change the radius, then I'm going to change the force on an object. So if I were to take the apple and put it where the Moon is, the force would be considerably less because the distance would be considerably more. Incidentally, the astronauts aren't that far up. So if you take the apple and put it where the astronauts are, the force of gravity on the apple would be very much the same as it is on the surface of the Earth, right? They're just a couple of hundred miles up out of thousands of miles to the center of the Earth. So the force of gravity hasn't diminished that much, only about 2%. When you go up to where the astronauts are. More questions? So one of the things I said last time is that these are really pretty surprising statements. They're not the sort of statements that you could see in action and then write down. Right, that's what Kepler did, right? It was hard work, but he had the data, and the only thing that explained the data were these particular rules. But we never actually see, for example, the first law in action. You've never seen an object move forever in a straight line. things usually come to rest, right? So if you take an object and you put it on the floor, it goes for a while, but it comes to rest. So there must be some force that's acting on it, and that force we call friction. If you take bigger and bigger, smoother and smoother objects and put them in motion, they go further and further and further. But still there's some friction or walls that bring things to rest. So one way he may have gotten this idea is by kind of taking the limit of that. If friction was becoming less and less and less important, then the object would have gone further and further and further and further and maybe gone forever. Now we can actually do a much better job than Newton can in terms of getting less and less friction. What I've got here is what's called an air track. So there are zillions of little holes in this piece of aluminum, and they're going to make an outflow of air that this glider can float on. There's still going to be some frictional force, but it's going to be hugely reduced because there won't be any contact, metal-to-metal contact, between the glider and the track. So if I turn this thing on, I know you can see it. I had to actually very carefully level this thing so that the slight difference in altitude didn't make it accelerate. And you can see that I didn't do it perfectly. Right? But it's very slow acceleration. But if I get this thing going, you can see it's not slowing down noticeably except when it loses energy at the bumps. And it's kind of imaginable that if this track went on forever, it would go on forever in a straight line. Now I can also set things up so that there is a very small force acting on this guy. Well, you saw that when the force of gravity was acting on it, it was accelerating a little bit. But here I have an object that is weighs, I don't know, at the end of the string, there's a very small piece of metal, probably weighs, well, maybe the weight of a few pennies or something. And I can have that very small object put a force on my glider. If I do it right. Yeah, get this in first. And I'll try and stop the penduluming. So now there's a very small force on it, and it's going to cause it to go kind of faster and faster and faster. So we can see if there's a force, there's going to be a corresponding acceleration. Now, we are talking here about Galileo for his work with telescopes, but he was actually the first guy to work out the details. And we have back here, so Galileo is sometimes called the first modern scientist. He wrote up his devices so we can duplicate them today. And this piece of wood is a duplication of what he did. So he was interested in looking at how objects fall, but that whole process happens so fast, it's kind of hard to visualize exactly what's happening. So he argued that he could have the same sort of effect. He could slow it down by having something work on an incline. So if I put this ball on this incline, you can see, start slowly, but it's picking up speed. Turns out that every second, the same amount of speed is being added to it. And he's the guy who worked out that precise relationship. That what was happening is the velocity was continually increasing for this rolling object. So if we were to plot the speed, the velocity, versus time, this thing is uniformly getting faster and faster and faster. So if every second it's going further and further and further, if we were to plot the distance it travels versus time, it turns out that it has some sort of quadratic relationship. As I say, Galileo was the first guy to work out this behavior for something that has a constant acceleration. Okay. Now there's another piece that is part of what Newton said that's worth stressing, and that is that if there's no force in a given direction, then there's going to be no change in the velocity. So imagine the following sort of experiment. So you fire a gun, at the same second, you drop a bullet. Which one hits the ground first? Yeah, they're going to hit it exactly the same time. This guy is going to have a constant speed as it goes out that way, but they experience exactly the same downward force. So second by second by second, they'd have pretty much the same altitude, and they'd finally hit the ground at exactly the same time. So the force of gravity is vertical, not horizontal, so it doesn't affect the horizontal motion. Well, they frown on firing guns in the classroom, so we have kind of a junior version of it. So here I have a device that is designed to drop a ball and hit a ball at precisely the same time. And the way it does that is by having this hitter, which disappears on one end at the same time it hits at the other. So if I put a ball on this end, and I let it hit a ball on this end, now I do have to try and make sure it's level. Does it look level? Looks pretty level. Now you notice the people up front can see that there, I know that you can't really follow this with your eye, but I put wood down here so that when those things hit, you should hear kazam, right? And if they hit at the same time, there'll be one bump. If they're hit at different times, then there'll be two click clicks. Right? Pretty much exactly at the same time. Okay, so the horizontal motion doesn't affect the vertical motion. So another experiment that Galileo, it's not clear that he actually performed it, but he talked about performing it, and that is that you take a heavy object and a light object and you drop them. So supposedly he went to the Leaning Tower of Pisa and took a heavy object and a light object, and with all of these Aristotelians around, he dropped them, because the Aristotelians claim that the heavier object, there's obviously a much bigger force on it, it should hit the ground first. So psychology, which is directly below us, frowns on me dropping the bowling ball. But here I got two balls. This one's made out of metal. It must weigh 10 times as much as this one. And I can't drop them at exactly the same time. Don't have that good reflexes, but pretty much, they certainly don't go 10 times faster, giving 10 times the weight. Pretty much they have the same sort of speed. So that's a real important fact that seems to be true of gravity. For gravity, in terms of the path that the object follows, it doesn't depend on the mass. Now obviously this thing weighs more, the force of gravity is much more on this than it is on that, but if I were to throw these things at the same speed, they'd follow the same path in the sky. So if I were to take an apple and I were to have it have the same speed that the astronauts are going in space, the apple and the space shuttle would go at the same rate, and they'd go exactly together at the same time. Okay, so it doesn't matter whether Pluto weighs as much as this or a lot more than this, the path of Pluto in the sky would be the same. Okay, so with that, let's take a look at some of these kind of cheesy demos that you yourself can play with online. Maybe I won't. Ah, here we go. Yeah. Would have bit me. So first of all, before we get to this kind of Newtonian stuff, let's take a second to take a look at one of these demos that shows what retrograde motion is like. So remember that retrograde motion has to do with the apparent backward motion of a superior planet as the Earth passes it by. And I don't know, this is supposed to demonstrate, here we have Mars, here we have Earth, and I can follow as Mars moves through the zodiac, moving in the same direction as the Sun is now, but not as fast. As the Earth starts to pass it by, it slows down, seems to move backwards. You can see it's not a huge effect, and then it goes forward again. So that's what retrograde motion is all about. It's pretty minor thing. Mostly the superior planets are just going in the same direction as the Sun, but slower. But there's that little jitter backstep that boggled the minds of the Greeks who were trying to make things be more or less perfect circles. So here we have kind of a model of the solar system, and notice that the inner planets are going more miles per hour than the outer planets, and that the precise time it takes to go around is longer for the outer planets than it is for the inner planets, right? You plotted that relationship for your homework. Mercury takes just 88 days to go around. Pluto takes, I don't know, 250 years or something like that to go around. The bigger the orbit, the longer it takes to go around. But it's not just because the planet has to go further. The planet is actually going fewer miles per hour if it's further out from the Sun than if it's inside the Sun. Question?
It looks like Pluto's orbit and Neptune's orbit like cross.
Yes.
Would they ever like crash into each other?
So you notice, so generally speaking, we'll talk obviously a whole lot more of this in the future. You notice that generally speaking, the orbits of the planets are in a plane, but that Pluto's orbit is inclined. So this seeming intersection actually happens when we have this sort of situation. So they won't, if we just turn the crank, it doesn't look like they're ever going to collide. But
although that'd be awesome.
Say again? Well, I don't care if it happens to Neptune. Wouldn't want it to happen to the Earth. So here we have just a demo that reminds you about this, about the basic facts about ellipses. Right? So remember that semi-major axis determines the size of the orbit, and the eccentricity determines how circular it is. Eccentricity 0 corresponds to a circle. Eccentricity 1 corresponds to a line. And we got those two kind of adjustable parameters that Kepler figured out for us. I'm going to hold off on that one for a second. So here come the cheesy demos to start with. Okay, so what we have here is something that I can change the mass of the ball, and I can change the velocity of the ball, and I can follow what happens when I throw this thing up. So I throw this thing up, goes up, comes down, and it has a maximum height of about 11.5 meters. If it were a lot lighter, still acts exactly the same, right? So the mass doesn't affect the path or the trajectory if something is just being influenced by gravity. It cancels out in a sense that we'll see mathematically maybe in a second. Okay, we can do the same thing on a bigger scale. Right? What goes up comes down. I hope it's obvious if I make the planet heavier, it's not going to go up as high, right? There's going to be a bigger gravitational force on it. It's going to reverse direction. If I change the mass of the projectile, it doesn't matter. So I can increase the speed. And what goes up doesn't necessarily come down, right? If it's going sufficiently fast, if it goes sufficiently fast, then it's not coming back. It reaches regions where the force is so small that it is insufficient to bring it back. If I decrease the velocity a little bit, I can make it go too far. Yep, too far. Try 11. I want it to go, that's kind of wimpy. Let's go a little bit more than that. See how close we can come. Notice that the things happen really slow out here because the force of gravity is really small because we're really, really distant from the center of the Earth. Okay, so there we just barely retain the ball. So escape velocity is this magic velocity where if you're, and it doesn't depend on the mass of the ball, if you're going that speed, then you're not going to come back. I can do the same thing in reverse, kind of. I can drop the ball. And notice that when I drop the ball at a great distance from the Earth, nothing much seems to happen because the force is so small. So we only get noticeable acceleration when we get very, very close to the Earth, and it's too bad for Africa. Not good to drop a planet on a continent. And I want to talk a whole lot about this particular slide. And what I want to, this is actually originally, yeah, it's probably just as fast to find it online. This is the original version of something that Newton actually wrote. So this is a figure from Newton's book. So this goes back to before 1700. And we'll go back to this situation. So what we're doing here is we're imagining that we've climbed some mountain and we're going to fire a cannon at different speeds. And we'll see, I won't stress it right now, that the mass of the cannonball isn't going to affect anything. But kind of no surprise, if I throw this thing pretty wimpily, it doesn't go very far. Right? If I throw it faster, it goes further. Yeah, if I throw it faster still, it goes further yet. And you can see what's going to happen. If I throw it at the right speed, it's going to be, hit that mountain. It almost went around. How about one more? So it's always falling, but it's always missing, because the distance it falls per second is matched by how much the Earth curves away per second. And this is obviously what orbiting is doing. You're always falling, but you're moving so fast horizontally that the curvature of the Earth allows you to stay at the same altitude. Right? So it is possible to always fall and never hit. All you have to do is have the right speed. About 17,000 miles an hour is what's required for the Earth. And again, the mass doesn't matter, right? If I put an apple where the space shuttle is and give it the space shuttle's speed, it's going to orbit just as well. So when the astronauts lose a glove and it floats away from the space station, it continues to orbit with the space station, right? So there's kind of a series of pictures that you've seen probably in lots of science fiction movies where the also-ran stars of some science fiction show have died and they're going to dramatically throw them into the sun at the end. So they throw them into the sun from their orbiting spacecraft. Well, it doesn't go to the sun, right? It just orbits around with the rest of them forever. If you want something to actually hit the sun, you have to stop it and then drop it. If you release it from something that's moving, it's going to have the same speed as the thing that was moving. Well, let's go back and see if I can fire it faster still. So, lost it. Too fast. We learned before that 11 was as fast as you could go. comes around if we wait long enough. There it comes. 24 seconds seems like a long time. So you can see we have an elliptical orbit if we shoot it a little bit faster than what's required for a circular orbit. And of course, when it's out far from the Earth, the force of gravity is small, everything's slowing down. 24 seconds still seems like a long time. And of course, we saw just a moment ago, if you shoot it too fast, it's not coming back. It may bend a little bit away from the Earth, but in the end, it's gone. So we have the same sort of thing that we can do in kind of a different format. Here I have an object that I'm a distance of 5 AU from the sun, and I'm going to have an initial speed of 4 kilometers a second. And you can watch the orbital radius. It's falling. It's getting closer and closer to the sun. Same time, the speed is picking up. Now it's moving away from the sun. The speed is slowing down, and we have an elliptical orbit as a result. If I throw it a little bit faster, you can see it's still falling a little bit. It's almost a circular orbit. So it's still changing its distance a little bit, but not all as much as it did before. Okay, so if you have the right velocity, a so-called circular velocity, then you're going to orbit in a circle. If it's too fast or too slow, you're going to have a corresponding elliptical motion, just exactly like Kepler said. Right, so now it's going to move out beyond where it was before. Well, no, it's not. More. Okay, so now you can see the orbital radius is increasing on the other side. At the same time, the speed is decreasing. And supposedly, if we wait long enough, then we'll be good. It's nice to have a name for this closest spot and this furthest spot. And it's unfortunate how this came about in that people have attached the name of the thing you're going around to the name of that closest spot. So if we're talking about orbits around the Earth, the closest spot is called the perigee, and the farthest spot is called the apogee. If we're talking about going around the Sun, the closest spot is called the perihelion, and the farthest spot is called the aphelion. The word for a generic case is ap, so para-aps and apa-aps are the cases where you're orbiting an unnamed particular object. Is that it for my cheesy demos? Okay. Questions? So the astronauts are always falling, but they're always missing because they're going fast enough sideways. And this is something that very frequently gets missed because we're all used to watching things take off, rockets take off. And they go more or less straight up. And so you get the feeling that most of what's required in order to orbit is to go up. But that's not the case. So actually, Hitler's V2 rockets went up higher than the astronauts currently go up. Going up is relatively easy. So very soon, the space shuttle turns over sideways, and it expends almost all of its fuel in order to accelerate up to 17,000 miles an hour. It needs to go up to get above the air resistance that you would have if you tried to do that in the Earth's atmosphere. But almost all of the effort is gone and going sideways. That's where you have to spend your fuel, in going sideways fast. So Mark Vandehei, the astronaut who was here last week, commented that the thing that he liked best about his training was riding what's called the Vomit Comet. So the Vomit Comet is a pretty ordinary airplane. And all it does, all they do with it, is they go up to altitude and then they cut off the engines. So the plane just falls. And since the mass, since the trajectory doesn't depend on the mass, the ball that's inside the airplane and the astronaut and the little bit of water he spat out of his mouth, they're all going to fall together. They're all going to seem to float. So for as long as the airplane is falling, they can practice behavior in weightless conditions. Now, you know, there are a couple of possibilities. One Mark didn't want to have happen, right? So the plan is to turn on the engines again, but then you are going to be subjecting yourself to extra high G as you accelerate. So you alternate situations where you are in free fall to where you have twice the force of gravity on you. But you know, they can simulate, I think, like a minute or so of free fall as the thing goes up and down. Okay, so if you want to simulate what it's like to be weightless, just go into that elevator and cut the cable. And for a while, less than a second, this ball will float in front of you. But you probably won't be able to tell anybody about it.
Let's try it.
I've never tried it, so I guess I don't know it's true. Sometimes seeing isn't believing, at least not for long. So one of the things I was stressing is that the speed that things travel, the path that they travel, doesn't depend on the mass. And let's kind of see how that works according to Newton. So Newton says that the change of velocity I can calculate as being the force divided by the mass. And the force, if it's the force of gravity, is given by this equation. So if I plug into that, the change in velocity is going to be the force. So this might be the mass of the object times the mass of the Earth divided by the distance that the object is from the center of the Earth times the time. But when I divide by the mass of the object, it cancels out. So the mass of the Earth is going to have a big effect, but objects with different mass are going to fall at the same rate. At the surface of the Earth, turns out that the acceleration is about 32 feet per second every second, which in metric units is about 9.8 meters per second per second. And it's usually denoted by the symbol G, the local acceleration of gravity. So again, maybe surprisingly, the acceleration of gravity for the astronauts in space is pretty much the same. Right? They are accelerating, but so is the spaceship. They're just falling together. They're not in a situation where the force is particularly less than it would be here on Earth.
Would things fall faster on the night side of the Earth than they would on the sun side of the Earth?
That's an excellent question. So let's run your argument through a little bit. So what you're saying, I think, is that here's the sun, here's the Earth. So on this side, an object is going to be pulled down by the Earth, but it's going to be pulled a little bit back by the sun. Whereas on this side, the sun and the Earth are going to be acting together. Turns out the answer is basically no. And it's kind of the same reason as the Vomit Comet. We're all riding the airplane that is the Earth. So the Earth is itself accelerating towards the sun. It's falling, and it's exactly making up for this force. So the force, pretty much the same on either side of the planet. But there's a big but that I think is going to surprise you. Bad phrase, huh? We have one particular fluid that shows us a lot about these small differences in the force of gravity, and that's water. Right? So the water, we have lots of water on Earth, and it will respond to any force. And what Galileo said is pretty much kind of what you were saying before. Let me rephrase what we've got. The sun is big, but the moon is close. And it turns out the moon has a bigger effect on us than the sun. But it's the same sort of story, and they both do have an effect. But let's switch gears to here's the Earth and here's the moon. So kind of a similar sort of argument. Galileo argued that the moon is going to attract the water of the Earth, and so the water is going to be piled up in the direction of the moon. And of course, as the Earth spins, that means we're going to go through one high tide per day. So how many of you have been to an ocean front, looked at the high tide signs? How many high tides per day? Two. Separated by about 13 hours or so. Two high tides per day. So what that means is this picture has to look like that. So it's pretty obvious what's going on here. Why is the water piling up on the opposite side? So first of all, let's back up for a second. This is really a surprising statement that Galileo would get wrong. I mean, you go to Florida and you can see the number of high tides per day. And Italy is in the middle of the Mediterranean. How did Galileo miscount the number of high tides per day? Well, it turns out the Mediterranean isn't that big and tides aren't so obvious. On the other hand, England's sitting out there on the Atlantic, the tides are quite noticeable. So Newton wasn't going to miss how many high tides there were per day. So I've got an argument which almost never convinces people, but I'll try it anyway. So imagine that I've got three balls and I drop them. And my idea is that the center ball represents the Earth, and these are various types of water. What's going to happen over time? Well, this thing is closer to the moon, so it's going to have a bigger acceleration than the Earth is. So it's going to move ahead of the Earth. Now, the Earth is certainly going to fall some, but not as much as this point. And this point, since it feels an even smaller force, is going to fall least of all. So you can see what happens is that this water is left behind as the Earth accelerates. This water moves ahead because it's feeling a bigger force. Now, what people don't like about this is, sure looks like these balls are going to hit the moon in a short period of time. But remember, I can have this whole thing moving sideways fast enough so that the distance each of them falls per second is made up for by the distance they move horizontally. And while we always talk about the moon going around the Earth is also going around the moon because Kepler's third law, right? If the Earth is pulling on the moon has to be pulling on the Earth. So the Earth has to be accelerated also. It's accelerating in a circle. So let's take a look at that cheesy demo. I don't know if it's in the moon section or not. I didn't see it in the other one. Oh, there it is. Okay. It's hard to see without my glasses. Did it get it? There. So you remember I said that the high tides were separated by about 13 hours. Let's see what's going on for that extra time lag. Please clean filter. So there are a couple of things that are present in this picture that details that we do want to, I guess, get straight. The first is that we said that the moon is closer, so it has a bigger effect, but the sun is bigger. It does have some effect. So what we have here are situations where the moon and the sun are trying to do the same thing, and when they're trying to do opposite things. Oh well. We'll restart it. So here we have the sun and the moon that are both trying to make a tidal bulge in the same direction, and you'll notice that the tides under these situations are extra big. Where's my start? Yeah. Okay, so now when the moon gets about in this position, when we have one of the quarter phases, then the moon and the sun are trying to do opposite things and the tides are relatively small. Now we're moving into a situation where the sun and the moon are trying to do the same thing, so the tides are relatively big. Now we're moving into a situation where the moon and the sun are working at opposition, so the tides are relatively small. So these are called spring tides when they're particularly big and neap tides when they're particularly small. And you can see this effect anytime you actually go to the beachhead. So the other thing that's present here is, if you notice, the bulge doesn't exactly point at the moon. The bulge is always a little bit ahead of where the moon is. And that's basically because the spin of the Earth is carrying the high tides beyond where they would be at their usual maximum. So if we were to stop everything, the high tides would actually point at the moon. But because of the spinning of the Earth, it carries the high tides a little bit too far. And that has an important consequence. So this means that there's kind of extra mass of the Earth that's trying to pull the moon ahead in its orbit. And so there's a force on the moon due to that water bulge that is trying to push it ahead. It's kind of like a rocket motor on the moon. So if the moon is being pushed forward, what's the effect? So you would think it was going to speed up. And I don't know, in a month we'll talk a whole lot more about that. But let's think about that. So here we have the Earth, and here we have an astronaut. And we said that in order for the astronaut to orbit the Earth, it's going about 17,000 miles an hour, and it's circling the Earth in about 90 minutes. Is the moon going faster or slower than the astronauts?
Same.
So let's go back to the solar system. Is Pluto going slower or faster than Mercury? It's going slower. So if we turn on our rocket engine, if the astronauts fire their rocket engine in the way they're going, they will go to a larger orbit and end up going slower. But right now my main emphasis is the fact that they do move out if they do that. So the moon is moving out, and we can actually measure that outward motion of the moon. It's a few centimeters per year. Over billions of years that'll add up, and eventually the moon will be stripped from the Earth by this process. Well, if you fire your rocket engine that way, you're going to go to a higher orbit. How about if you fire your rocket in the other direction, so-called retro rocket? So what happens is you're going to slow down and let me make my picture lots bigger and exaggerate things. So the astronauts really are just slightly above the surface of the Earth. So if you're going to see a scale model of where they are, you know, they would be about there. But let's have them be way out. So if we fire our retro rockets, we're going to convert ourselves to an orbit that would be kind of like that. So we convert ourselves to an orbit that will intersect the surface of the Earth. Luckily, we don't do it at high speeds because we go through the atmosphere, and that's going to slow us down, in addition to, of course, the parachute that's going to slow us down at the very bottom. Or in the case of the shuttle, of course, we just bleed off that speed and then land in a conventional fashion. questions? Okay, well, I guess we'll call it quits there. So, chapters 1 through 4, take a look at the old exams. Encourage you to come in and talk to me. Encourage you to come to this help session. None of those are required, but I think they're good ideas.
I have stuff going on from 6:30 till 8:30. Mm-hmm. So I was wondering if you could come in sometime earlier so we could go over the whole help session.
Oh, like this afternoon?
Yes.
Sure.
Hi, would you be in here or where's your office?
My office is down 2 floors.
Okay. On the first floor or on the...
Well, so these words first floor are confusing, right? So, because there are different levels. Yes. So it's on level 1.
Okay.
So if you come in like from the library, you want to go down 1 floor.
Okay.
So it's 115.
115.
And this is like 319, this room that we're in.
Okay. 115. Okay. I'll come in maybe hopefully sometime after 1 o'clock. I have class and I'll grab lunch and I'll come right over here because I need to get this thing down.
Sounds good.
I found out that I have to work tonight, so I won't be able to come to the help session, which I thought I'd be able to. So is it going to be recorded and put online or anything?
So, I'll record it like this, and that helps a little bit.
Okay.
Yeah.
Alright.
It's better than nothing. What is probably even better, though, are the screencasts of the old exams.
Okay, I'll be looking at those. Thank you.
We'll see you. I'm going to leave this bowling ball here for the time being. Okay, one, and the other one should be here someplace. And I wonder if I'm ever gonna find it. I did